Okay, welcome everybody to our first official senior fellowship class 2020-2021. We begin with a pre-Rosh Hashanah class, get us into the proverbial Rosh Hashanah zone. Rosh Hashanah just a few nights away, starting Friday night, all over the world. And so here we're going to, and the motif of the general classes are going to be sort of a merging of various texts, stories in the Tanakh, of course, but introducing to you to interesting characters that, like the character I'm going to introduce you tonight, that I don't think anybody here knows, ever knew. In fact, I myself did not know this person until I did research. So, but we'll bring these people in as a way to exemplify different concepts. In other words, the curriculum is based upon a blending of past and present to bring out certain core concepts of Judaism. That's the curriculum thing. So the title of the class is Breaking Bad, An Anti-Zionist Leader Goes Zionist. So we're going to start off with some videos, as I like to do. So without further ado, let me get to the video. As I said, let's go to the video tape. Okay. I'm introducing to a person named Yehuda Meshi Zahav, who is the founder of Zaka, which we'll get into. So just this is a, he's speaking what he does so frequently as part of the introduction to a, tragic, a terrorist scene in Israel, the stabbing at Har Nof. But let's get into it here. Oh, I can't share screen because I'm not the host. This is a problem. One second. What am I going to do about this one? This, I did not work this one out. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. I'm going to have to deal with that with the office because I'm using the East Side thing. I'm going to put the link. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to put the link of the video in the chat. Everybody will watch it themselves. But mute yourself so you can watch the video. And we'll reconnect, okay? That's what we have to do. I didn't realize this. Technical glitch, so I'm putting in the chat. Here we go. So, just watch the video. It's a minute and a half. And just mute yourself so we don't hear any... okay, so let's...
I don't remember ever seeing a disaster scene as shocking as this. The victims were wrapped in tallit and tefillin, puddles, rivers of blood throughout the entire synagogue. Siddurim thrown all over the floor. A sight.
All right, so just raise your hand when you're done watching the video. Okay, we got the hand raised. Okay, you ran. Okay, good. It's only a minute and a half, so I should not do that. Okay, so who can tell me who is Yehuda Meshi Zahav? He's the founder of Zaka. What's, anybody familiar with this organization? Anybody seen this before? We got Chaim Fishoff, yes, one. Anybody? All right, guys, all those who are, I encourage to send out the video. We want to create a community. Please put your videos on or as soon as you can. And, you want to share that with everybody else. So it'd be helpful. Thank you. Okay, so appreciate that. Okay, so Yehuda Meshi Zahav, which we're going to learn about, he's founded this organization of Zaka, which does two things. It does search and rescue in Israel. And other places. In fact, they've actually sent teams to far-flung places like Haiti, etc., where there have been natural disasters. And as well as they got their beginning when basically when tragedy occurs and there are remains of bodies, they gather those remains for proper Jewish burial. Before that, basically the police would come, they would take away what they would take away, and they would leave remains and I'll wash it away. So, according to Jewish law, you gotta bury the body and all its, I know it's gonna sound a little gruesome, all of its parts, which is a sort of a very not glorious job, but it's something which gives people tremendous comfort when, if it's their funeral. So, but then they expanded, their search and rescue canine components. They just expanded. It's all volunteer. And Yehuda Meshi Zahav, who's a chassid, as you saw, he's a Hasidic Jew, is their head. But he's very interesting. So I'm going to send you this next video. I'm going to, put it in the chat. Watch this one. He comes from a very interesting background. He is the nephew of the founder of Nature Karta, which you'll now learn about if you don't know it yet. So I'm going to send this in the video.
Rabbi, I don't know if you said this part, but even when there were sharpnels and explosives, they would send people with those little cycles and the motorcycles, whatever they call the scooters, and they would come and get the glass with the blood, every little last bit.
Right, they're very comprehensive in their approach to ensure that all of the remains of the person is buried in accordance with Jewish law. But they've expanded that to search and rescue, and they're actually quite sophisticated. So they're an additional sort of a volunteer search and rescue organization. I'll put their whole.
Do they have anything to do with the guys on the motorcycles that have like the little mini ambulances?
So that was another class. First of all, Scott, a regular in our Parsha class, we did United Hatzalah. United Hatzalah has the AmbuCycles, which goes on, and they're able to get to as a first responder. They have that component. They got a lot of different. They've expanded their elements, so they're part of the mosaic of search and rescue of in Israel. Of course, you have Magen David Adom, which is sort of the national. Let's call it the ambulance corps. You got United Hatzalah, which come with their AmbuCycles, and Zaka does search and rescue for some of the difficult circumstances, and also when they have to deal with human remains. I'm going to share you also that as well. One second. So, hold on. Apologize. This is a little bit about. This is Zaka one, and I want you to. But here's what I want to share with you is that he was. He was a active member as a nephew of the founder of Nature Karta. So if you don't know Nature Karta, I just sent you a video. It's 2 minutes. Please watch that right now. We can't. I can't share screen right now, but I'll have to deal with that tomorrow. So watch the video. And then raise your hand when you you'll get the whole point. I'll explain it. This is part of their Purim celebration in London and in Israel. Again, I encourage everybody to put your video on so we can have a sense of community. Thank you.
The state of Israel cannot speak in our name. We are Jews believing in God, and there are atheists that don't believe in God. We're going against God. So that's the message that we want to bring out.
I raise your hand when you're done watching the video. Okay. So, raise your hand if you've ever heard of Nature Karta before. So most MGEers, when have you? There is a one event that MG traditionally does once a year that we have an encounter with Naturi Carton. Anybody know when that is?
The Israel Day Parade.
Correct, Erica. Correct, for 500 points in the square. Yes, every year on Fifth Avenue, Naturi Carter will be protesting Israel. So I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a crash course in Naturi Carter. So they were started in the 30s. Stephanie tells us also APAC, correct? They're around. And basically, they split off from Agudat Yisrael. Agudat Yisrael is an umbrella organization of the Yeshivish and Hasidic community in America, the Agudat Yisrael of America. So back in the 30s, and why? Because they felt they were going soft on Zionism, that the Aguda was being too, accommodating to the Zionist cause. And basically, they maintain, very simply, is that there's only one Jewish state, and that is a halachic state, and that has to be founded and initiated by the Melech HaMashiach, the King Messiah. And to do this initially, I think you may have learned this with Rabbi Wild in his Zionism course, to do this initially goes against a midrash in the Talmud that talks about there are three oaths in the that the Jewish people will not go back and take Israel by force. So there's a whole question: is a religious Zionism in violation of that? Somehow that's a whole conversation. Now, so basically they're 100% against the state of Israel. Now there are people who are non-Zionists who are like neutral, and then they're anti-Zionists, and then there are anti-Zionists who will, as you saw, every Purim. Why do they do a flag burning on Purim? Who can figure that out? This is an advanced question, but you guys are senior fellows now. Scott Shapiro, Gad, why?
It's because they believe that the Messiah can't come if there's a state of Israel right now.
But why Purim though? Why do they pick Purim for a special special ceremony of flag burning? All right, Stephanie.
The Maccabees, the big great victory that they
had? The Maccabees is Hanukkah. Purim, Mordechai, Esther, Haman, yes.
It's the only holiday doesn't take place in the land of Israel. It takes place in Persia.
Well, Pesach does not take place in the land of Israel. It takes place in Egypt. So, that's not why. So, because they identify... Okay, Max.
Well, so I don't know. But
you guys seem like an extreme zealot here.
What?
Go ahead.
Is it because in Purim the hand of God is hidden, and so they think that they're trying to bring it forward and having a Jewish state?
Well, no, but they're against the Jewish state. They think what?
I know.
Okay, I hear that. It's even much more extreme than that. They identify the Zionists. What?
Intermarriage?
Nope.
I'll take a guess. Correct guess.
Good.
Because they look at Zionism as preventing the next redemption Gula coming, because we came in and we created a government in the state of Israel, which if we do that, we're preventing the next redemption.
But what's that got to do with Purim? In other words,
they don't think the Medina is Haman, do they?
That's
they're
it.
Trying to put them
That's
there.
It.
No.
Exactly. In other words, worse. No, worse than Haman. In other words, they view... Guys, that's it. That's it. They view the Zionists as a Amalek. Haman is viewed as being a ideological... a descendant of Amalek. So on Purim is fitting, part of our protesting and making noise of drowning out Haman and by extension Amalek, they burn the flag because who is the modern day Amalek? Obviously, the Zionists.
Oh,
Rabbi Pini, why doesn't Israel kick them out?
Freedom of speech.
What does that mean? It's not freedom of speech. It's like openly hot. It's not everything is protected in Israel like it is in the States.
So we're gonna get. That's an integral part of our story. Let me allow me to share this slowly but surely. Bring you into this whole story. It's very interesting. Okay, now, are Neturei Karta people, are they Hasidic?
No, they're Satmar, right?
Well, Satmar Hasidim.
They're not even Satmar.
Correct.
They're mentally ill.
Okay, that's they're not mentally ill.
No, there is some. Isn't it a girl?
They're not mentally ill. No, that they're not mentally ill. Okay, guys, we don't want to get it.
Well, I guess that was the wrong thing to say. I apologize, but their fanaticism is.
Oh, they're like, okay.
They're like the Taliban of Israel.
So okay, so we're gonna
tell
we're
us
gonna
how you really feel. Don't hold anything.
No, that I regret saying mentally.
Okay, so
they are akin to the Al Qaeda or the Taliban. They're dangerous.
Okay, so hold on. All right, so Daphne is we're getting Daphne riled up, which is the way I like a good class. Okay, so we're gonna take this slowly but surely here. So they are actually not many of them are misnagged. In other words, not Hasidic, but they are Haredi. So they look, they look Haredi, they dress Haredi. Now, they're so extreme.
Wait,
we're going to get into that. Hold on, Max. I'm going to get to you. Go ahead. Say your question.
Oh, why do they dress Hasidic if they're misnagim?
Okay,
how
good.
How did that happen?
Good question. So they view themselves dressing more as a Yerushalmi, as a Haredi Yerushalmi. So that dress sort of like blended in together, because the Jews that made Aliyah in the early 1800s were really the students of the Vilna Gaon. So they dress like Eastern European people. Hard to tell the difference between the Chassid and the Misnagid of the Yerushalmis. They have their own mode of dress. Basically, it's a transport.
By the way, that's still today. There are a lot of Yerushalmis today that misnagdim, that they wear the strimal and the bekshon, and they are misnagdim. They're
correct.
They're just regular and whatever.
Can I get a translation for some of the words that were just thrown out that people who did not grow up as religious or didn't spend a year in Israel, Max, and might not know necessarily.
Okay, I'm gonna translate the words. I'm gonna translate the words. Okay, now
thank you,
Jesse. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, so terms.
I could have nodded, but I wouldn't have gotten any of it.
Okay, so the term Haredi, which means literally from the word Haredim, which means those who tremble. It's from the Tanakh, viewed as a very righteous person. They're trembling before fear of God. Okay, is a general term identifying all a whole reservoir of Jews in Israel and by extension worldwide, which will include Hasidim with their famous payas and the shtreimel, which is the fur roundabout hat. And the long coats and the white socks to the knees and, those little Amish shoes. Okay? Okay? So they have Haredim who are misnagid, which means they are not in agreement with the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. They don't belong to any of the famous Hasidic dynasties. I'll list the famous dynasties. Satmar, Bels, Vizhnitz. Those are the big ones. Ger, those are the big dynasties, and there are tens of thousands of them in Israel, in each group. Classic non-Hasidic Haredim are part of the what they call Litvish. Litvish means from Yiddish means Lithuanian. They transplant themselves from Lithuania. Their arch father figure. Theological, ideological father figure is the Vilna Gaon, who was the one who tossed, who declared that the Baal Shem Tov should be excommunicated, and all Hasidim should be excommunicated as being a sect of Judaism that has gone off the rails. Okay?
Yeah.
So these guys, back to our Neturei Karta Chevra, these guys, they are part of that world. But they're so radical, as Daphne said. The other people view them as, I don't know what, crazy, or I don't know if they use the word crazy, but having extreme views to the degree that they have their own synagogues, schools, and like communities. You know what I'm saying? In other words, they're so radical that the other seemingly radical anti-Zionist says, no, those guys are crazy, okay? That, you know what I'm saying? Satmar, the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, who died in the 70s, was virulently against the State of Israel. But he didn't have the same aggressive, violent protests that we saw here, okay? These people take a much more muscular, protest-oriented approach to that. Now, some are very consistent, which is they don't accept any benefits from the State of Israel. I don't accept State of Israel. I'm not taking it from you, okay? Some anti-Zionists somehow work that they can take money from them. I don't know. It's a mitzvah to take money from them. Yeah, money talks. Everything else walks. Exactly. All right. So now what general education do you think these people have? Feel free.
Just brainwashing. Brainwashing, not Torah. That's, I don't know what
Torah
is. Not Torah.
Thank God.
So they're going to get a Haredi education, which means very limited general education, but with a sprinkling of these very extreme views about Israel. Okay. So what do they do? What's their profession? What do they do to support themselves?
Learn Torah.
So they'll learn Torah and they'll do professions that don't require higher education, which is very common in the Haredi community. Okay.
Diamonds
is all, yes. So that's what, buying and selling diamonds. It doesn't, you know, it's buying.
Are we talking about Neturei Karta or something?
Yeah, in other words, but because they're part of the Haredi world also. In other words, they're just viewed as a fringe element. Now, we started off with a video with an interview of Yehuda Meshi Zahav, okay? You know, interviewing about the tragic incident in Har Nof. And before he got into this, what was his identity before this? He was literally the, I'll call it the crown prince of Neturei Karta. He was the up-and-coming next-generation leadership. His uncle founded it, Rav Avram Blau, and he, following in his footsteps, I'm just going to share with you, in fact, does everybody have the sheet that I sent you? Everybody got the video? All right, so I want somebody to read. It is coming from the very interesting quote from the newspaper. Can anybody pull it up? Anybody got it? Can just read it? It's from the Israel21c.org site. Raise your hand if you got it and you can read. All right, Shana, quick on the draw. Go ahead.
Though Meshi Zahav's life story could easily be mistaken for a screenplay, he is real as the flesh and blood he encounters at the scenes of accidents, crimes, and terrorist attacks. Growing up in the insular Jerusalem neighborhood of Mea Shearim, he was ingrained to distrust the other and to disdain Zionism as evil. Arrested 34 times for anti-Zionist agitation. The Haredi community is set up with walls to protect us from outside influences, Meshi Zahav said, speaking in Hebrew, translated by his former media spokeswoman, Lydia Weitzman, and Zaka Development Director, David Rose. I never knew there were Jews who act and behave differently, and that they are also good people. The 11th generation Jerusalemite was taught that there was a correct and incorrect way to do things. And if we did something the incorrect way, we were called Zionists. This same man, who proudly lit the torch ushering in the State of Israel's Independence Day celebrations in 2003, was arrested 34 times at anti-Zionist demonstrations as a youth. At some point, the young Meshi Zahav developed an affinity for the police, who apprehended him time and again. I began to see them as regular people who wanted to go home to their families after a day's work, he relates. I started to see that a lot of things could be settled more easily by just sitting and talking to one another. With this revelation as a backdrop, on July 6, 1989, Meshi Zahav heard the explosion and subsequent screams emanating from a bus driven into a ravine by a terrorist. He and some friends rushed to the scene, determined to help tend the wounded and collect scattered body parts and blood for burial. Though his mother had set a volunteering example with her regular visits to terminally ill patients, Meshi Zahav knew neither first aid nor forensics, but he knew Jewish laws regarding human remains, and he discovered that no organization in Israel was authorized to do this gruesome but sacred work. His life took on a new purpose. Even though we Israelis have different opinions about how the state should be, the time had come to live together. Over the next 6 years, he laid the groundwork for ZAKA, a Hebrew acronym for Disaster Victims Identification, the only group of its kind worldwide. It is recognized by the United Nations as an international volunteer humanitarian organization. Donations make up most of its funding. About 10% of the budget comes from the government. During the Arab uprising, or Intifada, from 2000 to 2006, Meshi Zahav and about 600 volunteers rarely slept, constantly on alert for the next call. Working knee-deep in blood, Meshi Zahav was fortified by his faith. At the time, I thought we were dealing with Kavod Hamei, honoring the dead. By the end, I realized that we were actually honoring the living, because a family whose loved one cannot receive a full Jewish burial has no rest.
Right. Okay, that's a very intense situation. So, Meshi Zahav went... So, very simply, before his epiphany, what did he look at all Zionists? What was he trained to look at as all Zionists?
They were the other.
They were the other. More than that. What else? Not just the other. What else?
That he thought it was wrong.
Anything evil that you can imagine, it's a Zionist. The Zionists are destroying the Jewish people. The Zionists, and they would, oh, they're atheists. They hate God. They don't keep Torah. You know what I'm saying? They're basically viewed as basically the enemy. In other words, they were trained to perceive that everything, the anathema of Judaism, what Judaism holds dear, the Zionist movement is undermining. So what happened did that change? How did he go from being the guy who is, in other words, burning, you know, arrested 34 times. That means like all these protests. We saw protests in Israel on a fellowship trip back in the early years, and they fight the police, and it's you know, oftentimes on Shabbos. There's all kinds of throwing of rocks at cars and burning of the Israeli flag. All kinds of fun stuff like that. What changed his mind? How did he go from being the crown prince of Neturi Karta to a person who was invited by the state of Israel to light the torch of the official Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day celebration?
Forced encounters with the police.
Go ahead.
Started to, I guess, humanize the police. Who were Zionists, I guess, so.
Right.
In his deep core, he was a truth seeker. So when he realized there were lies, he went to search himself.
Right. So I put another link to another... he wrote a... I put the link on the
page. He's going to conclude that you should just arrest them all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's something about, like, having... I don't think he was a truth seeker and he purposely went out of his way to find out good things. I think he just, after being arrested 34 times, I guess you just kind of know the cops' names at that point, and maybe you start to humanize them a bit. So maybe arrest them 34 times. I don't know.
So I'm just going to read you. He wrote a letter. I put the link on in your sheet. We wrote a letter. It's called... I mean, it says that you were wrong. A letter from Yehuda Meshi Zahav to his uncle, Rav Amram Blau, founder of Neturi Karta. And he published it in the yeshiva world, which is like a Haredi thing. So not only did he leave that group, he's now aggressively fighting that group, and he's repudiating them. I'm just going to read you one selection. This is how far he's talking about his uncle. In your many sermons at public meetings, I was shocked by stories about the various events during the campaign of destruction waged by the Zionist regime. Cantonist decrees, that's the Tsarist decrees. You called them. You called the Zionists, you said the Zionists are guilty of all troubles of the Jewish people, including what? The Holocaust. So from the Neturei Karta perspective, who caused the Holocaust? The Zionists. Okay? All right. Okay, I was counting.
Wait, I don't understand the logic of that. Israel was only created after the Holocaust.
No, well, the Zionists were active from the early, Theodor Herzl had this Basel, the first Zionist
right.
Congress was 1896.
The Zionist movement, which was the root of...
Right, Hashem is punishing us. Hashem is punishing us
right.
for doing that. And that the Holocaust is a punishment for the Zionists.
Because we weren't as religious as they were, right?
Not because religious, because we had no right to start a state of Israel and run it by non-Torah values.
I thought they believed that like the Holocaust was because we were like becoming more European.
That's a different. We don't know the reason for the Holocaust. I'm just saying this is their. I'm just saying part of their ideology. But then he says like this. Today, after 7 years of a Zionist state, we are happy to inform you, my dear uncle, that your fears have been proven false. We have a wonderful Jewish Zionist state that serves as a model for all the countries of the world, education, health, immigration absorption, and Judaism. About 7 million Jews, over 50% of the Jewish people, already live in the state of Israel. And in Jerusalem alone, we approach 1 million residents, which is not certain even was during the times of the Beit HaMikdash. He says, who would have believed that after 73 years after the terrible Holocaust, when the people were almost extinct, and there's hardly any trace of terror and Hasidism, we'll have a Jewish state of our own, the state of Israel, a state which the world of Torah will reach a prosperity unparalleled in the history of the Jewish people since Melech Hizkiyo. Well, there's not been so much Torah study in the land of Israel as today. And you'll be surprised to hear who's the greatest Torah scholar in the world. Who is the greatest Torah scholar in the world? The Zionist regime. Every year, the Israeli government invests billions of shekels into the Torah world. All right, so he's a repudiating. You can read the whole thing yourself. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he's a completely opposite of what. Basically, he felt he was sold lies, and everything you're saying is that the Torah, the Judaism, that the state of Israel is against Torah. What are you telling them? They support. Yeshivot of all kinds to billions of shekels a year. They're Jews that are observing of Torah. And you have freedom of religion and there's et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on and it goes a point by point repudiation of his uncle's ideology. Okay, let's now take it to Rosh Hashanah. We're going to be blowing the shofar on Sunday. I would like to somebody read from the sheet the Rambam Laws of Tshuvah, one of the most famous statements of the Laws of Tshuva in regards to Rosh Hashanah. Who would like to read? Any volunteers? All right. We got Scott. Take it away.
3-4, right?
Yes.
Even though the sounding of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a decree, it contains an illusion. It is as if the shofar call is saying, wake up, you sleepy ones, for your sleep and your slumber arise. And you who slumber arise. Inspect your deeds, repent, remember your creator. Those who forget the truth in the
vanities. Distractions.
Of the time and throughout the entire year. Devout their energies devote their energies to vanity and emptiness, which will not benefit or save. Look at your souls, improve your ways and your deeds, and let every one of you abandon his evil path and thoughts.
Okay, so the Torah, does the Torah say why we blow the shofar? Does anybody know what the Torah says in regard to the mitzvah of shofar?
That you have to hear it.
Not even that. It says, Yom Teruah Yeh Lachem. A day of shofar blasts, it should be for you. Very vague. Okay? So it doesn't tell us why, and the oral law tells that we blow the shofar, but certainly why we blow it. He says there's an allusion. Now, there's obviously an intrinsic hint. What is the next holiday following Rosh Hashanah?
Yom Gedalia.
Biblically?
Yom Kippur.
So if Yom Kippur is about repentance and Kapara, atonement, the Day of Atonement, which is openly mentioned in the Torah, obviously, if this is 10 days prior, obviously this must play an instrumental or a preparatory role. That'd not be a ridiculous theory. So the Ram says, the shofar blast, when you hear it on Sunday, is basically saying to us, wake up, you sleepy ones from your sleep, and you who slumber, arise. Inspect your deeds, repent, remember your Creator. Those who forget the truth and the vanities of time throughout the year, get lost in distractions, who devote their energies to vanity and emptiness, which will not benefit or save, look to your souls, improve your ways, and your deeds, and let every one of you abandon his evil path and thoughts. So basically, the shofar essentially is a, you can call it a tshuva alarm clock. It basically is there to shake us up a little bit to step out of our comfort zone and look at our past year, at our life, and see, are we living the life that, are we living the best version of us that we could be? Are there parts of us that we can improve? Are there relationships that we can mend? That's what the shofar is supposed to jar us. And I think, you know, in a typical shul, it has an impact. Everybody's quiet. The shofar blow, people, it is, I think for most people, they do feel that on a level. Okay, so now bring it back to our character here, Meshi Zahav. In what way was Meshi Zahav's picture of Zionists a figment of his imagination? In what way is a person locked into imagination rightfully described as being asleep? Who would like to take a stab at that question? That's question number 12 if you're following on the sheet.
I think he was locked in the imagination of what he had heard Zionists were, like the underlying belief, versus actually finding out for himself. And that's why it changed when he increased his interactions with them and saw them as human beings. And so he was asleep in the sense that he wasn't fully aware of who they were, the same way when we're awake and we can be fully aware of our surroundings. When he started to connect with them as people, that's when he was waking up.
Correct. In other words, if you would interview, members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and ask them what they think about Israelis or Zionists, they wouldn't have the Jewish religions component, but they would basically have a similar ideological vision. That they are the embodiment of all things evil. Because they've been basically, as Dafna says, they've been taught a certain narrative. That's their imagination. You know what I'm saying? They're fed certain pieces of information. Certain information is withheld from them. And therefore, an entire narrative, a false narrative, is filling their mind. Okay? So when they see the people, when Meshi Zahav, before he was getting arrested on the 34th time, looked at these Israeli soldiers as basically Nazi, Jewish Nazis. Okay? You have to understand how intense his ideological commitment was. Okay, he's locked into that paradigm. Okay, similarly, so therefore he's inserted in so far as the reality, he's asleep. He's asleep to the reality. He's completely locked into a certain vision of things. Now, in what way is Meshizov's imagination image of Zionist a sin? In what way did the sin of mind lead to other sins? And did he think he was sinning? We're talking about when he was an anti-Zionist protester.
Well, is it a sin? I'm not sure what sin it falls into, but is it something about, I don't know, taking on almost like the role of God, being so absolutely sure in your own ideology and your own notions of the world? That's what fanaticism is in a way. It's a sin, I guess it's a sin of pride.
Well, there is a category in Jewish law, which you may or may not have heard, called Choshed Bikshirim. You're not allowed to suspect a kosher person. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you don't assume, unless you have reason to do that, as the doctor was saying, you can't just indict somebody saying, this person is a terrible person. A person is assumed to be, on average, we have Havidan Lekol Adam Lekav Schus. You judge every person meritoriously. And you certainly don't suspect a good Jew. You know what I'm saying? So to ascribe that every person who's not a Neturei Karta member is a evil person who is destroying Judaism and responsible for the Holocaust is a terrible sin.
Can you say that falls on the category of sin at plenum?
Yes.
Okay. Is that what you were talking about?
No, it's all the above. It's to be choshed is to suspect somebody of evil when they're not evil. One, two. We have an obligation to judge people favorably. Three, and therefore it results in basically being baseless hatred. You're just indicting people and criminalizing people for no reason. Now, if you asked him before he had this epiphany, you said to Meshi, would he believe that he's a sinner? Adrian, would he have viewed himself as a sinner?
No.
What would he have said?
Said that he's fulfilling the Torah and
yeah. I think not just not a sinner, but like a savior, like someone who's going to save the Jewish people or like show them the way.
Exactly, he is fighting the Milchemet Hashem, the war of God. These people are a dangerous cancer that's undermining the underbelly of the Jewish people. They need to be stopped. And everybody's been, and he thinks they're in lost in imagination, and they have been corrupted. Really, they are the true bearers of the truth of Judaism. Now, the fact that they only represent a small fraction of even the Orthodox world, much less the Jewish world, to a person who's truly ideologically committed, not a problem.
I don't think that's really the flaw. I don't think that going against the majority is...
It is not. Correct. It's not.
Correct. Because in Germany, Nazi Germany...
Correct.
Against the majority was actually a virtue. I think really the main problem is the arrogance and, that's one problem. But another problem is just, like you said, the motif that you attribute to the other party doesn't share your views and seeing them as the children of the devil that are actually out to do evil in the world rather than respecting that they just have a different point of view.
Exactly. Right. It's not about the majority because remember, Avram Avinu was the only person who recognized the oneness of God living in a world of idolatry. So the fact that everybody believed in idolatry does not make it correct. And
what's the name of the sin, Choshed?
Choshed Bikshirim, suspecting a good person, a kosher person, of evil, of an unjustified casting aspersions of evil with no basis. I'm sure there's a better translation, but that's basically it. That's what it means. You could tighten that up a little bit, but that's what it means. To choshed somebody is to suspect them of wrongdoing. Bikshayer means a kosher person, a good person. And to say everybody in Israel is a bad person, okay, it's a little insane. Okay, question number 14, we got a rock here. What happened to Meshi Zahav's imaginary picture of Zionist when he recognized his sin? What event caused him to change his mind? How did this change of picture change his behavior? Who can answer that? Question 14. I'll start calling on people if you're going to be quiet. All right, so I'm going to have new people. All right, Melissa. Melissa. So, question 14. When he recognized his sin, what did he do? Melissa, you with us? All right. Next, who wants to take the question? All right. Anybody, any other volunteers? All right, Nicole from New Orleans.
We won on Sunday, but I just want to let everybody know that we won against Tom Brady. Okay.
By the way, that was duly noted.
Thank you. I think that he saw the reason why the terrorist event was meaningful was because it was like Dad was actual evil. As opposed to what he had in his mind of what Zionists were. Here he actually saw, like, true harm being done to people. And so maybe that's why that played a role or why that was meaningful to him.
Well, so I don't know the exact chronology because he had that event, which was traumatic, and that gave him his mission, his life mission. But then was the issue of him being arrested. I don't know if it was a one event, but he basically recognized that his whole narrative about the police and the state of Israel was wrong. So once he started to do that, there was a radical change. What happened then? He went from being from what to what? He had a big journey. Jordy? So
he went from being an anti-Zionist to a Zionist.
Hold on. Just a Zionist?
Well, he saw these people as people and as other, first of all, other Jewish people and as humans, and seeing them for who they truly are, that they're just like him, that they have families like he does and that they have jobs like he does, and everything that he, you know, was taught to just assume because they were different physically, they looked different than him, was totally false and incorrect.
So he went actually to literally the other extreme. He is a vocal, proud Zionist. Two of his sons went to Golani, which is on their own decision. But his children are now members of the Israeli Defense Force, which he then used to call them as, the ruling infidels. Okay, he went from being, in other words, his tshuva was he went from being these people are wicked and say no, they're not wicked. I was wicked for believing that these are bad people. These are great people here, and he did really, which is the whole point. He did tshuva. He did tshuva. His whole sense of his sense. It started with his sense of his understanding, and then it filtered through his behaviors and how he. And then he became a vocal proponent for the state of Israel. A very vulnerable. Now let's take it back to the United States of America. In what way is every member of a group or ideology vulnerable to Meshi Zahav's imaginary war on enemies? Give an example from the current presidential election.
I know
One at a time. This is a softball here, guys. I'm starting you off easy here. Come on, Stephanie.
I want Daphne to talk about QAnon. Daphne.
Oh gosh.
Well, there's so many examples of just the crazy, I guess, cults that have started to show up in this country. Antifa, QAnon.
No, but I'm saying, but specifically in the presidential election. What is it?
Oh yeah, there's no civil discourse anymore. It's like it's a black and white war against. There's never been this much. I guess like almost hatred from the Democrats and Republicans. It's either you're with us or against us mentality. That's very dangerous.
If you go on to CNBC, you will listen to their painting of the narrative that Trump. Is a demagogue who's going to destroy the world. Republicans are evil, and Joe Biden is the Melech HaMashiach, and it's going to and bring out the proper and just values and redeem America. You go on to Fox News, the Democrats are destroying America, and our savior, President Donald J. Trump, will lead us to victory from these insane people on November the 3rd. So there's nobody could do anything right. Nobody do anything wrong. That basically it's a war of each one viewing it in purely ideological terms. And now it's literally a war of enemies. Okay? So there's not a conversation. There's not a discussion of ideas, not a discussion of policy. It's just a war of ideologies, and so Meshi Zahav is an example of a victim of a war of ideology, and who was brought into that world, believed that, and through his own life experiences was able to release himself from that ideological paradigm. Okay, he had a tshuva. He heard the shofar. And slowly but surely, and then he transformed himself. So that, of course, I'm using this as an example, obviously, as question 16, in what ways every hate, every sin, based upon an imaginary picture like Meshi Zahav? What happens to false pictures when we recognize our hate? You know what I'm saying? Every sin let me explain that. Every sin presupposes an imaginary sense of things, an imaginary good. So when we recognize a sin, and we recognize the falseness of that, the harm of that, what happens to that? What happens? I mean, it's basically...
Oh, when you
see that, go ahead, sorry.
When you see, like, the human impact of the sin, or really anything you do, right, if you see it differently than if it's just happening, right, if you tell gossip about someone and it never comes back, then it's like, oh, I just told the story. But if you then have to interact with the person you talked about and they heard that you said it, right, it takes on a different meaning to what you did.
Yes, yes. In other words... When we talk about Lashon Hara, we commute what Lashon Hara is defined as negative information about a fellow Jew. What we're really doing is hurting their social standing in the community. We're reducing them. And, which is embarrassing. It's sort of like a social assassination, it can be. So we just think we're just being funny. We're telling a great story. We're just schmoozing at a dinner party. You know, we're just having drinks. We're having a conversation. We're having a schmooze. It feels okay. I'm just having engaging conversation. So that's the fantasy. I'm just having engaging conversation. The reality is I'm destroying somebody's reputation, their sense of how they are depicted in the community, and now they're reduced and marginalized and sometimes can be devastated. So when a person sees that clearly, that the instead of like I'm just being cute, funny, engaging, and I see that I'm really engaged in systemic social homicide, I view it differently. So that's true for every chait. Every chait, every sin presupposes that. Let me finish out the shir. I got. Let me give me 2 minutes, and then I'll send the people wherever you send me to. Go. All right, I gotta go.
Oh. Well, if you wanted to have the meeting yourself. Oh wait, the
Canadian. We're back. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. This is Rabbi Wilds is locked out of the meeting also. So we're just knocking it out of the park here tonight. Anyway.
Don't worry, we know exactly how.
Okay, good. So let's go on. So what do people believe about Shabbos who are not Shomer Shabbos?
Okay, so saying basically, well, if they can never do it, how can they do it a night work, say there's a night where they can go out to meet their friends or a day where they're going to be stuck in the home and it's so difficult.
Anna, just hold your mic like right here. Because it floats in and out behind your hair, so it like gets low and then gets really loud again. No,
that's not the reason. Oh, we're just. But I heard what Anna said. She says that people. You tell me if I got it right. What I heard from Anna is that people who do not keep Shabbos. How could you live life? You'd be able to go. You don't be able to go out. You're restricted in so many ways. So many different ways to party and enjoy things, and it's just nothing but 25 hours of imprisonment. Now, if you ask people who keep Shabbos, how do they feel? Very generally. I'm gonna reach out to somebody. I'm gonna reach out.
I couldn't
to...
survive without Shabbat.
Okay, so but why is that? Don't you feel? Aren't you feel?
Because life is nonstop. Otherwise, it's the only time that you can really stop and disconnect to connect. Even like without using all the frum terminology, but like to a lay person, and like even my clients, I'm like, it's the perfect, like my phone is off, I don't have on technology, I don't think about work, I just am in the moment with the people I'm with. And everyone's like, oh, that sounds really nice.
Correct. So, exactly. So, basically, if you without Shabbos, a person can be stuck on the rat race 7 days a week and will not stop. Constantly look at the phone, constantly... you know, social media, constantly taking, you know, in other words, does everybody here take a work email past 5 or 6 p.m.?
All the time.
All the time. So if it wasn't for Shabbos, basically you would work 7 days a week. And that's it. You'd basically your whole life be consumed. So people don't, so it's counterintuitive. Shabbos is a good example. Shabbos, the fantasy is, it's so restrictive. The reality is, it's so liberating. Let's finish up, and then I'm going to, let me get Rabbi, the next question is, epiphany about dating non-Jews. What prejudices do non-observant Jews believe this mitzvah impose upon them? What do people believe, like, why are you being so limited to only date Jews? What do people believe about that?
Restrictive.
Well, why restrictive?
Racist.
Racist. There you go.
Elitist. Chosen people. And then you can't date people that aren't Jewish. Sounds a little bit elitist. I'm just saying.
Right. So you're being racist. You're being elitist. There's so many wonderful people that you can't have a relationship with. So what does a person who's committed to dating only Jewish realize?
That there are shared values.
In other words, if I want to have. If I value Judaism and I want to have a Jewish home, I need a partner. How am I going to pull this off where the other person is not on the same, doesn't have an education, a background, values, and cherishes what I cherish? How can we raise a child together if we are so radically different in our core values? It's just not going to work. It's a train wreck. You know, a relationship is hard enough when you have those values. How much more so when you don't have those values? So,
last thing for your in-laws to not like about you?
Okay, so that the in-law thing, but that's really, but in-laws, you know,
answer.
All right, but that's not why. In other words, there's nothing wrong with a non-Jewish person. They can be a wonderful person. They often are. It's just that they don't have the same core values, and you can't create a Jewish home with somebody who's not committed to that. and is measured by, and that in a certain sense it also applies, you know, technically you can marry a completely secular atheistic Jew. They are technically legalistically Jewish, but they also
same problem.
But the same problem. In other words, you've avoided the halachic technical problem, but you have the same practical problem. You know what I'm saying?
You're so, talking about in regards to like Shabbat and keeping a kosher home and stuff like that.
Yes, and Shabbos, kosher, whatever level you're at, whatever. But let's say you want the child to be,
day school,
Jewish holidays,
or even Hebrew school,
or you don't want to have the kid go to their grandparents' Christian, Christmas celebration.
Then you have to get a Hanukkah bush.
the Hanukkah bush. Exactly. So that's that.
Wait, but then I get less presents. I'm about to get double presents.
Exactly. So let's finish up here. Last one. Epiphany about learning Torah. What irrelevance do non-learners believe about learning Torah? People who don't learn Torah, and they look at people who learn Torah, what do they think? So, okay, you guys all spoke at once. Go ahead. Max, and then Chaim.
I lost it. Did he make a joke? My headphones died.
Okay. So what do people who don't learn Torah look at people who learn Torah?
Who are these non-Torah learners?
I know, Max, it's shocking to believe, but there are those who are in that category.
I can't even imagine this thing.
But
what a waste of time. What's the purpose?
You're wasting time. You're learning irrelevant details about ancient law. What value does it have in improving my life? I want to not know about it more. But a person who is learning Torah realizes, and I think the proof that you guys are on for another year of the senior fellowship, whether you be a first year or a fifth year of the senior fellowship, whatever it may be, is that you are in fact being lifted, that your vista about life and living is expanded by it. It's an experience of growth and not of limitation. It's an experience of development and not of being cut off from, reality, the real world. So these are different. Again, what I'm sharing with you are epiphanies that you have personally experienced as a sort of a template of what the Kol Shofar, the Shofar sound, is to call upon us. So that's what I wanted to share. And...